For many people with migraine, the world can feel like it's full of invisible threats. A coworker's perfume, a freshly painted room, or a simple trip down the cleaning aisle in the grocery store can be enough to trigger an attack. These reactions aren't in your head. Research is uncovering how certain smells and the tiny airborne chemicals behind them, called volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, can directly influence the brain's pain and sensory pathways. Today, we're joined by Professor Gundrun Gosrau, a neurologist and migraine researcher, to help us understand why some people are so sensitive to scents, what the science says about VOCs, and how we can reduce the impact of these triggers in daily life. Dr. Gosrau, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Hello, and thanks for the invitation.
So to start with, can you explain what VOCs, volatile organic compounds, are and why they're relevant to scents or odors and to people with migraine?
So VOCs are basically ubiquitous, available in our daily life. These are, you know, organic compounds, as the name says, which are involved in many, you know, cosmetics or detergents, things of daily life that we use for cleaning or for disinfection. For instance, substances like formaldehyde, they can have really impact on your well-being, especially on your nose, on your eyes, and also the respiratory tract. And they work basically with an activation of your sensory nerve fibers. So especially the trigeminal nerve is affected by them. And then they can directly have an influence on your migraine. This is a thing that some people do not think about when they use it in the daily life. But you need really to consider to change and to be very careful with your daily products.
Are VOCs only things that have odor, or can some of them be odorless?
They don't need necessarily to have a big odor. The major point, what they do, is this activation of the trigeminal system. So they can have also some like chemical effects, also direct effects on the central nervous system. So they can also go via the lung into the blood and in the brain. And it's like solvents, solution, and they can even have an impact on the balance of the neurotransmitters, you know, dopamine, serotonin, GABA, all transmitters which are so important in balancing the central nervous system, also in involved somehow in migraine disease. And of course, the effect can be in like a migraine headache, but of course you can also have general effects by this, like concentration problems or dizziness.
So these either scents, or sometimes not scents, just chemicals that are out in our environment, can penetrate the blood like brain barrier, and they can also influence our trigeminal nerve and just cause irritation or inflammation that can trigger an attack and discomfort. Am I getting that correct?
Yeah. And the other thing is that you have often mixes of it, you know, you can barely think about what is it in this mix. You know, there are also examples from daily life. And when you go in a room somewhere, there are different kind of substances, and it's not easy to say this is that and this is that, but somehow all together. And then you need to be like the inspector and finding out what is really the problem that matters for me. But there are also other effects of this box. They can also, when they are in a very high concentration in a room, they can also, you know, influence your breathing. They can even lead to like a neuroboxia, you know, to the reduction of your O2 intake, which is another way it can harm you, you know. I think for migraine, the most obvious is the effect on the trigeminal nerve, but this VOX can go in many ways. It can also, you know, cause an inflammatory reaction or a stress reaction, and have an impact on oxidative stress in the the gingiva. It's like basically in the soft tissue in the mouth and throat, you know. So they can have all, where they basically affect, you know, when you breathe it in, it can lead to inflammatory reactions. So it can release prostaglandins, cytokines. And of course, these are all things that activate an inflammatory cascade where you get also a pain reaction, because it also stimulates pain receptors, you know. And then there are these people, I think you maybe ask later about this, but these people with a multiple chemical sensitivity. And for those people, it's especially harmful.
Is there a threshold concentration, or do some patients react to even trace amounts?
Well, I think trace amounts shouldn't be the biggest problem. I think it is, of course, depending on the amount. So more, so worse. And of course, some people are more sensitive. So for some people, already a small amount is really harmful, and some people can stand a bit more. But after a certain concentration, it's basically for everybody a problem, you know, when you breathe it in or so. And where you find it very often, you know, in inks, when you paint basically the walls, or when you have some glues, something to stick some things together. These are the material that releases it. But it can also come from relatively new furnitures, or if you have a new floor somewhere, you know, all this chemical production or chemical interior of rooms can release it. But another big thing I think that is even more common is really the soaps and detergents and things that you use to clean the floor, or that you use to disinfect the floor.
Okay, so we mentioned a lot of things right now that can cause these attacks that might be issues. So if you have a new piece of furniture, or you installed new vinyl flooring in your home, is there something you can do to mitigate the compounds coming off of that? Do you need to air out? Does it diminish over time?
It diminishes over time, and therefore it is the best if you have it really new to let it basically breathe out and not live directly in it, or if you have just a piece of furniture, to leave it somewhere where it can lose the higher concentration of these substances basically, you know. But of course, when you have a newly established floor or something, you should avoid for some time that people are spending their long hours, long time. Of course, sometimes this is not it's not possible, or sometimes it's forgotten, and then people also react. This happens. There are examples, you know. There is the work medicine, and in work medicine, often these topics are very relevant, you know, where people and employees get problems in the work environment.
In regards to things that we buy for our home, like detergents, dish soaps, body products, are there certain chemicals that we can find on the label that are good to avoid?
Well, it's individual, because if you speak really about cosmetics, there shouldn't be primarily toxic agent in it. So it should be, you know, have a seal for environmental, you know, tests, something like this. You should look that you get a better product when if you use it for your body or for personal belongings. But on the other hand side, even good products, if they contain, for instance, something that is activating also the trigeminal nerve, it doesn't need to be something really harmful, because it can be already a kind of a smell also, you know. But if you individually are very sensitive for it, it can be a problem. Also, in reality, it's not necessarily bad, because we have been talking about Vox so far as the toxic, you know, things that are in some detergents or in some products or in inks also. But of course, Vox, in principle, let's say a relatively harmless odor, a smell, is also a Vox in a way, you know, because they are often not very stable, and then but still it's can be like an organic substance that you really smell, you know. And we also use it when we do, for instance, a smell training, that we use sniffing sticks for, that there are also carrier substances from with an organic background, but also this, let's say, the artificial smell that we use are also sometimes organic substances. So just want to say that it is not necessarily like a poison or something really problematic. It can also be a harmless odor, you know. It is also something where you don't even think about it as a problem, you know, and especially when you think about our patients, some of them really get problems with let's say, high quality products, you know, or in general, when they are more exposed to. I do have a patient, for instance, and when she started to work as an employee in a shop in a drugstore, there were so many different smells and things that she couldn't stand it. You know, she had to quit this job because it was terrible. And then she has something where she has relatively less. You know, in a bakery is not a problem, for instance. So this of course has an impact.
An impact, yeah, across your entire life. This makes me think of how does osmophobia, the sensitivity to smells, differ from having odors as a migraine trigger?
It is basically here, the migraine attack, you know, that is some people have an aura, some patients like up to 25%. And then you have here photophobia and phonophobia, but also osmophobia. And this is where we are really talking about or where we are really interested in. And this is a study that we did in migraine patients, where we asked them basically when they do have their osmophobia, you know, whether it's just before the migraine attack, during the migraine attack, or also in between the attacks, you know. And we asked also how many of them would have really smell or odor triggered migraine attack. And there were like 30% of patients saying that really a smell can trigger an attack. And we saw that just right before the attack comes, 38% have already osmophobia. During the attack, it's like 62%, so almost two-thirds. But also in between the migraine attacks, so normally when everything is peaceful, let's say, also it's like almost one-third of the patients do show osmophobia. So this means that even in between the attacks, the life is not really normal, what we know. But also in terms of senses, in terms of reaction to odors in the daily life, it is influencing a lot. And we asked our patients which type of odors would be especially nasty for them. The highest percentage or the most unpleasant odor was basically sweet perfumes, you know, from what you have in daily life a lot. If you have somebody crossing the street and just next to you with a very sweet perfume, it can be a problem. But the other thing, there are also smooth food smells. So basically like you have a piece of meat, roasted piece of meat, you know, something like this is nasty. Cigarettes, but of course from cars, you know, the old air, you know, the used air. In general, also rooms with a bad air quality, but even flowers, of course, the ink, you know, when you're used to color some car or something, this is a problem. Or even nail polish, which also is very chemical, gas, and some other things. Yeah, but you wanted to know the difference between the osmophobia and really the odor-triggered migraine attack. So basically, there is a difference, but somehow it goes in each other. So it's a continuum, basically. So some patients are especially heavily affected, that you really give them a smell and they get their migraine attack. We saw it in our studies. They basically could see that the migraine attack would basically start like 120 minutes on average after the patient got this special odor. So it took like 2 hours to induce it. And it was especially seen in one-third about of migraine patients who got really a migraine triggered by the odor. And then in this study, they also investigated patients with tension type headache, with other primary headaches, and there none of them would get induced an headache attack by the smell. So this was something specific to migraine, obviously.
So we covered a lot in that question, and I don't want this to slide by. Is the fact that when you were doing the research, that people with headache but not migraine did not have pain induced from odors?
this was actually a study from Spain, and they could clearly show that it is something relatively specific for migraine that you can really trigger it in about 1/3 of patients.
Could Vokes hitting the area post-drama be causing some of these issues? One of our community members asked this question.
The connection on an anatomical level between the olfactory and the trigeminal system, they are very closely with each other interacting almost. So there is already in the periphery of the body, in the nose, a direct connection between the trigeminal nerve and the olfactory nerve. So there is a very close intermingling between these two senses, basically, on peripheral level, but also on the central level. And this is where we expect a lot of this work. But we mainly want to shape what we see in the clinic of the osmophobia, because we do also have a big outpatient for children and adolescents. And we see clearly from the olfactory side difference between migraine patients who are young and who are older. What we investigated is the so-called smell test. So basically the olfactory function in patients. And we could clearly see that patients with migraine have lower olfactory function than patients healthy patients. Everybody expected it different, but it was like this. And interestingly, patients who have a migraine with aura are even less well able to really distinguish also different smells. Here was investigated the olfactory bulb, you know, the organ basically of the smell, where also the neurons are located. And there was a measurement of the volume. And you would also think that somebody who is extremely sensitive to smell and also therefore osmophobic, like a migraine patient, would have a huge olfactory bulb because it is so sensitive. And in fact, in the study, it was the opposite, you know, that those patients who are very sensitive to smell had a much smaller olfactory bulb than the others. And they had also a less good olfactory function. And this goes along with the fact, if you are afraid that a smell, something can trigger your migraine attack, you avoid it. And when you avoid smells in general, which happens then often, also your olfactory function becomes less good. And this is the important way that we see, you know, it is like almost a behavioral thing also, because when I know a smell can induce my migraine, I avoid smells. But this means that in general, I avoid smells and I do not have such a good olfactory function anymore.
The studies have found, which is kind of crazy, that the olfactory bulb in people with osmophobia and migraine patients is actually smaller than in people without it, which seems counterintuitive, because we would think if you're more sensitive, that means you're receiving more stimulus and data and information. But that's not the cause.
Yeah, but for this, I need to go back what I started to say about the children and the adolescents, because we did also study olfactory function in children and adolescents. And there we saw that they are actually very normal in their function. So this means this process of the osmophobia and fear to have a smell seems to really change the behavior towards smells. And as a reaction or as a result of this, you avoid to have smells and you lose a part of your ability to smell things. We have patients who lose for other things their smell, yeah, the olfactory potential. And you give them every day for like 3 to 6 months things to smell that say really improve, like a training, you know? And this means that the threshold that they start to smell things is becoming higher and higher, in a way that I say it now correctly, that they can smell better and better higher solutions of the odor. So over time, they increase the ability. And we do in migraine basically the opposite. We avoid more and more of the smell, and it needs to have then finally more and more concentrated smells that we really smell something, because we always avoid. We make sure by learning. But what we saw in our patients, because we did with them, also with migraine patients, a smell training. And in the smell training, they could really choose only smells which they really liked and where they were also feeling comfortable with. And with this, over 3 months, we could see they could improve their ability to smell, and none of the patients got a migraine attack. So there is a lot of, you know, like taking the right smell. So it means taking a smell, an odor, which activates mainly or almost only the olfactory nerve, because we have many odors which activate olfactory nerve, but also trigeminal nerve. You know, many of this peppermint, whatever, there's always a little bit of a trigeminal component. And when you activate this a little bit, this plays into your migraine. And therefore, the patients, when they take something that is, let's say, harmless, like white chocolate or something, then they don't induce the migraine attack. What we found is also that basically age together with disease duration has an impact, or is, let's say, patients who have a longer disease duration have more of orthophobia in percentage also. And also chronic migraine patients have also higher amounts. So more disease load, so it leads you to even more of this osmophobia, which comes together with this behavior of avoidance of smells. And we did not really discover everything yet of this. We have to continue. But we know for sure that this interplay between olfactory and trigeminal system is very important. And there exists one animal study even in this. So a researcher from Heidelberg did it with mice. And what they did is they put mice in different cages. They had in one cage a very, let's say, a nice smell, and one unusual, and in one a very aversive smell. And then afterwards, they were giving them something like, or during this time, giving them like little pain stimuli. And then it was a bit hard, because they investigated later what happened in the trigeminal nuclei in the brainstem of these mice. But they could see that these mice who have been in the cage with a very positive smell, it was they had less of a pain reaction on the basically cellular biological level. So this is another thing where we can, with a pleasant smell, obviously influence. But I think we really need to put more research to get the right time point. You know, obviously in childhood, the osmophobia behavior is not yet so dramatically expressed, what we see. And it comes then, I think, over lifetime. So we need somehow to do something to change also the behavior, but also to find out more what really triggers then about the smell to really have it like more as a therapy.
Is it that children don't have as much negative reaction to it because they don't associate certain smells yet with pain? Is this part of like neuroplasticity, that people need to do some sort of brain retraining to so that they can feel safe around scents again?
In part, but only in part, because there's a lot of real, let's say, biological messaging really between trigeminal and olfactory system. And in terms of children, you need to know that the olfactory ability is increasing with age. Basically, when the children are something like, let's say, 14, 15 years, they have a very well-developed sense of olfaction. But for instance, children of like 5 years of age or 7 years, they are still basically improving year by year. It's also about, you know, they need to learn the different smells and train. But then when they are like 15, they have reached, I think, a good quality of assessment of smells and abilities of olfaction. But this means also, so younger the children, so less they can already allocate a smell by knowing, you know, to realize the smell is dead. And the other thing is also the olfactory threshold is still improving. So there is a developmental, and for sure it is neuroplasticity, for sure, because you see also in the olfactory bulb what I showed you, this is pure neuroplasticity, because the olfactory bulb is this region in the adult brain that is able also to still increase, you know, but normally we don't have this so much, but the olfactory bulb is, of course, it's that place of also regeneration, basically. So I think there we need to do certainly more research, but this is extremely interesting. And of course, it has an effect for daily life that we need to tell our patients, yes, you need to be careful because it can trigger. But if you do not lose so much of your olfactory ability, it is probably better, and it probably prevents this circulus, this vicious circle that we have, you know?
So how do you advise patients who are walking that fine line between not wanting to lose olfactory presence skill, I guess you could call it a skill, but also don't want to have an attack triggered every time they leave their house? How do you navigate that?
Now, first of all, you need to find out whether the patient belongs to this, like up to 30% who really has a very solid attack answer to a certain smell. Because if you have a patient who gets after a certain whatever mixture with let's say peppermint and something else, always an attack, you cannot convince these patients to take, you know, a training with peppermint. This doesn't make sense. But we need to have all the other patients who are, of course, afraid, but who see if they have, let's say, harmless smells like pure olfactory or almost pure olfactory, that they can have it. This is an important thing, because this let's say phobic aspect is also something that we shouldn't, as a psychological aspect, a little bit that comes with it, this fear, this we need to address. But we need to do a fine phenotyping of patients, because, as you know, everybody's individual. We cannot treat maybe one group like the same like others. So there will be a group that can go relatively more normal through life, but one group needs to be a bit more careful, let's say.
Would you advise people to wear maybe a mask in public if they have issues with running into people with perfume, or if they have problems maybe if they are visiting someone in the hospital? There's a lot of chemical smells, cleaning products there. Is that something you advise or something we want to avoid?
So if you are in this, let's say, high-risk group, then you need to be a bit more careful, and then we would advise that you have avoid certain kind of chemicals, you know. But if you are belonging to the two-thirds of the other group, then we can tell you, yes, it is, of course, that you are osmophobic in the attack. But if you continue to expose yourself to, let's say, rather harmless smells, you will in the end have a better outcome, and you will have less of a chance to increase more and more osmophobia. But this is something that I discuss with my patients about, but this is something that we need also to study in bigger prospective studies now that we really have this grouping, you know. I believe it is like this, but we need to do more research in this. But I think it's relevant, and you know, there are also patients from the work environment who really get, just because they change a certain detergent in the clinical environment, they get triggered migraines and headache. You know, we have lots of nurses with migraine, and this is, of course, a risk factor for them, you know.
We do know that the migraine brain loves stability. So anytime you change an odor that you use in your daily life, you can mess up your whole system. People in our community were also asking, is there a chemical that is similar in all of these triggers?
We are not yet there that we say there is this one. I think it is quite individual, but for sure, usually there is trigeminal activation by it. One other thing, it is also interesting that patients with migraine aura, also migraine patients with aura and without aura, seem to differentially, elaborate on smell. So basically, when we activated them with different trigeminal and especially olfactory stimuli, that they showed in the high resolution EEG, electroencephalography, a different pattern. So meaning that a patient who has migraine without aura has showed different basically brain potentials after stimulus and then somebody with a migraine with aura. And this already tells us that also these two groups should be treated differently. And this is also something that you need to consider, whether in general, when you have a migraine with aura, that you need in general to be more careful than if you have a migraine without aura.
So I want to make sure that I absorbed this correctly. Your studies are finding that patients who have aura may have more sensitivities than patients without aura.
What we did in this study is to see that there is a different way how the brain of patients with migraine with aura, let's say, reacts to, let's say, a chocolate stimulus compared to a patient with migraine without aura. This is already telling us that there are obviously also differences. I mean, there are some work about it, you know, that this is kind not really a distinct disease, but there are some clear differences, of course. But also this is for the future. We need to consider this in our, you know, when we have to counsel patients or we have to give some advice. So this is obviously important that with aura you should be a bit more careful with this odors also.
That's really good to know, because I think sometimes people who have aura may feel that way, but without concrete scientific evidence, they might not feel comfortable enough to advocate for those extra steps for themselves, whether it's extra medicines or whether it's being more assertive in the workplace and asking for extra protections. So I'm really glad you brought that up. So we've mentioned the smell test several times, and I want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. It's important even for people, or especially for people who have scents as triggers, to continue to have exposure to scents, because you don't want to lose your ability to differentiate between odors. It's almost like when we had COVID and people lost their smell, you made them smell a bunch of things to kind of bring back. Is that similar to what's going on?
Is it similar with the one point that in migraine patients who know they are triggering, odor, sometimes you know it, you need to be careful that in your training you involve more odors which are mainly olfactory stimulating. So this is like chocolate or more rose, you know. I would start to really with pure, so with one single smell. Also, you need to see when we did the smell trainings in the study, the patients had like 10 different smells that they could choose. But they have chosen a lot of this also, like rose, but coffee also, that they liked it a lot. And what we could also see that over time, there is more of an acceptance also of this citrus smells, you know. Also, you activate also the trigeminal system with it. There is over time more acceptance. And these are the things where you asked me for neuroplasticity. Yes, there must be something. And I think it is also more like a steady state between these two, you know. There is the olfaction on the one side and the trigeminal activation, and the one goes up and up. And you need to balance them well. Because otherwise, if the olfaction goes too low, you have too much trigeminal, too much migraine, and then you have some balance, it's better for you.
That's so interesting.
If you understand what I want to say, hopefully.
Yeah, so if you're not getting enough olfactory or olfaction input, it can affect the trigeminal nerve?
Yes, it makes them more sensitive, actually. It's like...
That's wild!
Yeah, but the point is that... For this, this is what we think from our studies, how we build our hypothesis. In principle, we would need to do now studies, you know, showing that really with the olfaction, you can clearly influence certain brain areas, you know, who are responsible for trigeminal, you know, or migraine. I mean, this would be good if you would have now, let's say, olfactory input, and you have, with this, you can silence, let's say, a certain pathways also. This would be really cool. I don't know whether we will get it, but this would be definitely very helpful to prove this, because for our point now, we are on like more hypothesis, or we have here and there, we have a little mosaic piece that tells us, yes, it's probably right. But yeah, but it's like an universum, and an universum of itself, and you can definitely work more on it. But of course, you need also to take over the important messages to the clinic, you know, for the patients.
Is this where you think the research needs to move towards?
It's not many people doing research with olfaction and migraine, actually, because I think in general, olfaction is not such a very common thing. It just pops up, like with, you said, the pandemic time and many people were affected. But in reality, if you look a bit closer to olfaction, that it has so many, it affects so many parts of our life, you know, from so many psychological things, you know, people who are depressed, they also lose their olfaction, or other way around. If you cannot smell anymore, you get also quite sad. You cannot enjoy your food anymore and so on. So it is a very complex thing. It's a very old sense, but of course, other things are maybe more pronounced often. But I think it's important, especially for migraine, it's very important because migraine is a disease of senses, no? So you should not neglect one of the oldest archaic senses.
Is there anything else you want our audience to know that we have not covered today?
Well, I would maybe encourage the patients, if they feel that that certain things, or that they basically face an increase in their migraine frequency, changing work or changing situations at work, that they try to check several levels, what could be the reason, but they should not forget to check also this side, you know. So I told you from these nurses who just increased their problems because they changed the substances in the soap that they use there, basically, you know, something like this, that you should be open-minded in this direction and also consider that there could be a problem, for instance.
And could something that you used in the past become a problem in the future? Like, I always use this brand of soap and it hasn't changed. Should I consider that even as a possible trigger?
Patients who are more and more chronified towards chronic migraine become more and more osmophobic. And at the same point, they lose their olfactory ability. So, of course, the whole thing has an impact. And of course, time and treatments, no? But I can also imagine that nowadays with better available therapies, we face hopefully less chronic migraine patients. This would be ideal situation. Also, with this, you would need to make sure that everybody who needs it gets it in the right time. And this is also a topic that we also face here in Germany, because of course, there is always the financial aspect. Yeah, but one should not underestimate the fact of this chronification and the brain plasticity that comes with it.
Are there any resources you'd like to recommend or offer to our audience?
We have a big awareness campaign running. It's called like ADHEC, Together Against Headache and Migraine. So we are working on that. And I can see that slowly things are changing, because it's a lot of work that you need to do in different levels of society, you know, and among, let's say, colleagues and in the medical field, but especially also really in society, in schools for children. This is maybe my other major message that I would give you, that one really should really take care of children and adolescents with migraine. Because this evening, before I came here, I had just this interdisciplinary treatment group that we established for the adolescents with headache and migraine. And you see how many young girls especially are facing a chronic migraine in the age of 16 or 17. And then I see them some years later and I see how much it impacts their life and their education. And this is where I say you need really early on to take care of these young patients.
I could not agree more. In relation specifically to smells or volatile organic compounds, are there certain protections we should be asking for in the workplace?
It's an important question, because in reality, somebody who is very sensitive, of course, should have possibilities to not to work in, you know, areas that are mainly polluted with whatever smells or things that could trigger the migraine. And there should also be a possibility of an employee to change the workplace directly, or to do breaks and so on. But in principle, if the workplace is a bit contaminated, it's probably the best to choose a different place. Because even if you go outside and have your breaks, and if this is possible, you still come back. And this is usually also not the best.
I want to thank you so much for your time today. We have explored so much, and my brain is still reeling from how much information you've given us. But yeah, this was great. Thank you so much.